Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Lantern. Want to welcome you all to the Bard's Grove, the storytelling hour with ancient fables and legends. Today, we'll be joined by some new readers that I know you're going to enjoy. We've got Margaret, who will be joining us to tell an African tale. Mickey will be sharing an Arabian Nights fable. Lillian will be telling us a story from ancient Polynesia. And I will finish one story of the two brothers and also tell a tale from ancient Egypt. To finish the story that I started last week, there were two brothers, one who believed in good and one who believed in evil. And when we left our story, the evil brother had blinded his brother and taken everything away, left him to fend for himself beside a healing spring. When night came, he fell asleep and he slept until midnight. This is the good brother. When he was awakened by the sound of voices in the spring, a company of Vilas were bathing and playing as they bathed. He was blind, as you remember, so he couldn't see their beautiful forms, but he knew they must be Vilas, water spirits, from their voices which were as sweet as gurgling water and as murmuring treetops. Human voices are never half so lovely. They must be Vilas. "Oh, sister," said one of them, "if only men knew that when we bathed in this spring, they could come tomorrow and be healed in its waters, the maimed and the halt, the blind, the lame. Tomorrow this water would heal even the king's daughter, who was afflicted with leprosy." When they had gone, the blind man crept down to the spring and bathed his face. At the first touch of the healing water, his wounds closed and his sight was restored. With a heart full of gratitude, he knelt down and thanked God for the miracle. And when morning came, he filled a vessel with the precious water and hurried to the king's palace. "Tell the king," he said to the guards, "that I've come to heal his daughter." The king admitted him at once to the princess's chamber and said to him, "If you succeed in healing the princess, you shall have her in marriage. In addition, I shall make you heir to my kingdom." Well, the moment the princess was bathed in the healing water, she too was restored to health. And at once the proclamation sent forth that the princess had recovered and was soon to marry the man who had cured her. Now, when the evil brother heard about this fortunate man, he could scarcely contain himself for rage and envy. "How did that fool get back his sight?" he said to himself. "What magic secret did he discover that enabled him to heal the princess of leprosy? Whatever it was, he got it under that fir tree. From where else could he have got it? I have a good mind to go to that fir tree myself tonight and see what happens." Well, the more he thought about it, the surer he was that if he went to the fir tree in exactly the same condition his brother was, he would have something wonderful, good, and good fortune too. So when night came, he seated himself under the tree, gouged out his eyes with a knife, and then waited to see what would happen. At midnight, he heard the vilas at the spring, but their voices were not sweet, but they were shrill and angry. "Sisters," they cried to each other, "have you heard? The princess is healed of her leprosy, and it was with the water of our spring. Who has spied on us? While we were talking last night, some man may have been hiding under the fir tree. Well, let us see if there's anyone there tonight." Well, they all rushed the fir tree and took the man they found seated there, and in a fury tore him to pieces as though he was a bit of old cloth. So that was the end of the wicked older brother. And you'll notice that in his hour of need, his friend the devil was not on hand to help him. So after all, it was the younger brother who finally inherited all his father's wealth, and in addition, he married the princess and was made heir to the kingdom. So you see, good is stronger than evil in this world. Well, there we go. We've got our first reader. Let me bring her on. This is going to be Margaret, I suspect.
Are you there?
Welcome, Margaret. How are you?
Greetings.
So tell us, you must have some interesting tale for us tonight. What mystery and magic do you bring us from old Africa?
Well, it's from a book called Kings, Gods, and Spirits from African Mythology by Jan Nappert. And
wait, Go ahead.
It's a section on fables. She says that fables are stories with a moral lesson at the end. They're a way of saying things in an indirect manner. Through them, problems can then be talked about without directly offending anyone, and advice can be given in an amusing and memorable way. In present-day Africa, this function of the fable is still very much alive, and there are thousands of them. Usually animals are the chief characters, just as they are in Aesop's fables. The following story teaches future chiefs how to behave properly. One day the elephant said to the rain god, "You are proud that you make the earth green. But if I tear out all the grass and all the shrubs and trees, there will be nothing left to make green. What will you do then?" The rain god replied, "If I withhold my rain, there will be no greenness anywhere and nothing for you to eat. What will you do then?" The elephant, trumpeting loudly, tore out the trees, the shrubs, and all the grass to destroy the greenness of the earth. The rain god then withheld his rain so that there was desert everywhere. Soon the elephant was panting with a burning thirst. He dug holes in all the riverbeds, but there was no water left. At last he gave up and prayed to the rain god, "Lord, I have sinned. I was proud. I grieve for my sin. Please let rain fall." The rain god remained silent while scorching day followed scorching day. In the end, the elephant sent the grouse up to the rain god to intercede on his behalf. After a long search, the grouse found the rain god hidden on a remote cloud and pleaded so eloquently with him that the rain god relented and promised to send some rain. When all the rain had fallen, it collected in a pool near the elephant's house. The elephant went to forage in the forest and appointed the tortoise as his watchman, telling him, "If anyone arrives to fetch water, say that this is my personal supply, and no one is allowed to take any of it." As soon as the elephant had gone, many thirsty animals arrived to drink, but the tortoise would not let them. "This water belongs to His Holiness the elephant. You are not supposed to drink from it," he said. But when the lion arrived, he hardly listened to the story. He simply looked the tortoise over, then brusquely told him to stand aside and proceeded to drink to his heart's content before leaving without a word. The other animals were encouraged by his example and came forward to drink. When the elephant returned, there was water left. He trumpeted angrily at the poor tortoise for not fulfilling his duties properly. The tortoise said in his defense, "Lord, I am only a small animal, so the others despise me. The lion just came and pushed me out of the way. What could I do?" They all drank their fill. Furiously, the elephant raised his foot and brought it down heavily on the tortoise, stamping him and kicking him. Fortunately, the tortoise was protected by the shield on his back, which since that day has been flat on one side. The moral of this story is, do not follow the elephant's example. Never defy someone who is stronger than you, like the rain god. Never destroy what you must eat, such as the trees. Never appoint a weak person to guard your treasured property. Never punish an innocent servant, such as the tortoise. Never be proud and don't try to keep everything for yourself. Always allow others in need to share your good fortune. The end.
Well, that was wonderful. Thank you, Margaret.
You're welcome. I have an affinity for Africa these days, for all the countries in Africa, and found that they have just as many fables and myths, as, if not more, than the rest of the world.
Sure, sure. Tell me, in the information that you gathered bringing us that story, did you learn what tradition, what part of Africa that story came from?
This particular fable is not identified. The book has fables from various countries, which include a lot of them. Kenya, Ghana, I'm trying to remember some of the other names of the countries I haven't been in yet.
Well, that's
and lots of ancient, you know, kings, about different kings. So throughout the time that we do this, I will contribute other ones from different
Excellent.
Parts.
Well, thank you so very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for including me.
Well, I appreciate you joining us, and I know you'll join us again. If you'd like to stay and listen, you can, or else if you need to go on, that's okay.
Okay, great. Well, enjoy. I'll listen as long as I can.
Okay, thank you. Let me bring
thank
on Nikki.
You.
Hello, Mickey. Welcome. Is this Mickey?
Lillian is here.
Oh, hi, Lillian. Okay, great.
Hi.
Let me see if I also have Mickey there. For now, Mickey is scheduled to be next. Could you want to stand by here?
I will certainly stand by, and in the meantime, may I ask Margaret a question?
I think she signed off, my dear.
Oh, okay.
Okay, hold on one second. Let me see if I got Mickey here next. Hello,
Hello.
Mickey. Welcome,
hi.
Welcome.
Hi, hi, hi.
We also have Lillian on.
Mm-hmm.
And here we go. Oh, it looks like Margaret's come back. She's going to answer that question. Lillian, hold on one second. Hi, Margaret. Welcome back.
I didn't dial one. I'm listening.
Oh. Okay. Well, Lillian.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you fine.
Oh, okay. I didn't dial one. I wasn't clear. What was the question? I thought I had to hang up and call back.
Go ahead,
oh,
Lillian.
Oh, hi, Margaret. Yes, I heard a
Greetings.
Story once upon a time. Greetings. I heard a story from Africa, I believe, once upon a time called Napambanaya. Now, it's been many, many years since I heard that story, and I'm wondering if you have it in that book of yours.
Not in this one.
Okay.
This one obviously has been pretty much translated to English. I mean, there are a lot
okay.
of countries that do speak English, but if you email me the name, I'll look for it for you.
Certainly will. I think it's a West African story, maybe from Ghana, and I haven't heard it in many, many years. I'd love to hear it again. I'll certainly do that.
Well, how about that?
Great.
We've got a request from one reader to another. That's great.
Good. Well, I actually have a friend whose sister is in Ghana, and she's on her way there this weekend. So
oh,
maybe
great.
I'll email her.
Super.
Great.
Well, let me invite Mickey to tell us her story next. Mickey, I understand you have a tale from the Arabian Nights that
yes,
was just recently published.
Not exactly just recently, but this version, this is translated directly, retold from the original Arabic.
Wow.
And apparently, before this was, the copyright on this book is 1978, but before then, at least, they did not. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm hearing all that loud.
Do you have your computer on? You want to turn it off if you do.
Turn my computer. Oh, I have the noise muted. That's not enough?
Yeah. We're hearing that echo.
Yeah. All right. Well, then I'll shut. Bye. Okay. There it's gone. All
yes,
right. So anyway,
better.
This is retold directly from the original Arabic, and apparently the Arabian Nights originally were not. And by the way, the author, who is a professional translator, said that although the Book of the Nights is outside the body of classical Arabic literature on account of its ungrammatical language and vernacular style, it has attained the status of a classic through translation and has become, you know, everybody knows about the Arabian Nights. So.
Well, tell us more.
Okay. This is the one called The Ebony Horse. A long time ago, there lived in the land of Persia a great and powerful king named Saburus. Not only was he rich and wise, just and honorable, but he also surpassed all rulers of his time in generosity, courage, and kindness. He had three daughters, each fairer than the full moon, and a son called Prince Kamar, who was a gallant and handsome youth. Every year, it was the king's custom to celebrate two feasts in his capital, one at the beginning of spring and other in the fall. during these two festivals, the gates of the palace were thrown open and alms were given to the needy and the poor. From the remotest parts of the kingdom, people came to lay their presents at the king's feet. On one of these occasions, the king was seated on his throne, surrounded by his court, when three wise men presented themselves. They were skilled in the arts and sciences and had invented many rare and curious objects. The first was an Indian, the second a Greek, and the third a Persian. The Indian kissed the ground before the king, wished him joy, and laid before him a truly splendid gift, the golden image of a man encrusted with precious stones and holding a golden trumpet in his hand. "Wise Indian," the king said, "what is the purpose of this figure?" "Your Majesty," he answered, "if you set this golden figure at the gate of your capital, he will be a guardian over it. For if your enemies march against you, he will raise the trumpet to his lips and with one shrill blast put them to the flight." "By Allah," the king cried, "if what you say is true, I promise to grant you all that you desire." Then the Greek came forward, kissed the ground before the king, and offered him a great silver basin, which had in it a gold peacock surrounded by 24 gold chicks. "Honored Greek," said the king, "tell us what this peacock can do." "Your Majesty," he replied, "at the stroke of every hour of the day or night, the peacock pecks one of the 24 chicks. Furthermore, at the end of every month, it will open its mouth, and you will see the crescent moon within it." "By Allah," exclaimed the king in wonderment, "if what you say is true, you have but to name the price, and it will be paid." Now the old Persian came forward, kissed the ground before the king, and presented him with a horse made from the blackest ebony, inlaid with gold and jewels, and harnessed with a saddle, bridle, and stirrup such as no king ever possessed. King Sabur marveled at the creature's perfection and at the excellence of the workmanship. "Tell us what it can do," he said. "My lord," the Persian answered, "this horse will carry its rider through the air, wherever he fancies, and cover a whole year's journey in a single day." "By Allah," he said to the Persian, "if your claim proves true, I promise to fulfill your dearest wish and utmost desire." The wise men were entertained at the palace for 3 days, during which time the king put the presents to the test. He found, to his great joy, that all the claims were true. The golden image blew his gold trumpet, the gold peacock pecked its golden chicks, and the Persian mounted the ebony horse, turned a little peg near the saddle, and soared swiftly through the air, alighting on the very spot from which he had taken off. "Now that I have seen these wondrous things in action," said the king to the wise men, "it only remains for me to fulfill my promise. Therefore, ask what you desire, and it shall be granted." "Your Majesty," the three answered, "these presents are beyond all price and can be exchanged for only things of immeasurable value. Since you have given us the choice of our rewards, our request is this: your daughter's hands in marriage." At these words, the young prince, who was sitting at his father's side, sprang to his feet. "Father," he cried, "these men are old and wicked sorcerers. They're unworthy of my sisters. Surely you will never agree." "My son," the king answered, "I have given them my word, and a king's word is his bond. And just think what I can do with this wonderful horse. I must have it, whatever the cost. So go ride it yourself, and then tell me what you think of the exchange." The prince vaulted lightly into the saddle, thrust his feet into the stirrups, and spurred the horse on. But it did not move. The king turned to the Persian, said, "Teach my son how to ride it." The Persian, who had taken a dislike to the prince because he opposed the marriages, went up to him and gave him some directions. As soon as he was shown the peg in the saddle that made the horse move, the prince touched it, and lo, the horse flew into the air so high and so swiftly that it was out of sight in a few moments. When after some hours the prince had not returned, King Sabur became greatly alarmed. "Wretch," he cried to the Persian, "what must we do to bring him back?" "I can do nothing, Your Majesty," he answered. "He gave me no time to explain the use of the second peg and went off without learning how to come back." Beside himself with grief and anger, the king ordered his slaves to beat the Persian and throw him into prison. Then he shut the doors of the palace and gave himself up to weeping and lamenting together with his wife and daughters and his courtiers. Thus their gladness turned to sorrow and their joy to mourning. Meanwhile, the prince had risen happily in the air until he reached the clouds and could hardly see the earth below. For a time he was thrilled with joy at the adventure, but before long he realized his danger and began to think of coming down. He turned the peg around and around, but instead of descending, he climbed higher and higher, until he feared he would strike his head against the sky. I am lost, he said to himself. The magician must have surely meant to destroy me, and yet there must be a second peg to bring this horse to earth again, if only I could find it. He felt all over the horse until at last, to his great joy, he touched a very small screw on the right side of the saddle. He pressed it gently, and at once the horse slowed down. After a few moments, it began to lose height as quickly as it had risen. The prince learned how to manage the peg, the screw, the bridle, and when he had mastered all the movements and reassured himself, he brought the horse to a comfortable height and journeyed at an easy pace so that he could enjoy the magnificent views stretching for miles and miles below him. Seated at his ease, the prince flew over countries and cities he had never seen before and gazed in wonderment at all the places he passed over. When darkness fell, he found himself circling over a beautiful city that shimmered with countless golden lights, in the midst of which stood a great marble palace flanked by six high towers. He pressed the screw and guided the horse until it alighted on the roof of the palace, and at the far end, he saw a door leading down a flight of marble steps. Leaving the ebony horse, he made his way down the steps, found himself in a marble hall lit with lamps and candles, where a black slave lay fast asleep, guarding the entrance to a room beyond. Without a sound, he tiptoed past the slave, and drawing aside a velvet curtain, entered a richly furnished room. In the center stood a couch of ivory and alabaster, studded with precious gems. Two young slave girls slept on a carpet near the door, and on the couch reclined the most beautiful girl he had ever looked upon. So beautiful was she that the prince fell in love with her on sight, and nearly fainted as he gazed at her. He approached the couch, and kneeling by her side, gently touched her hand. Her eyes opened, but before she could utter a sound, he begged her to be calm and fear nothing. "Who are you, and where do you come from?" she asked in some alarm. "I am a prince," he answered, "the son of the king of Persia. It is my good fortune that has brought me to this palace, gentle lady, but if your people find me in your private room, my life will be in danger. I therefore beg of you to protect for your protection." The girl, who was the daughter of the king of Yemen, answered, "Have no fear. You will be safe with me." She roused her slaves and ordered them to give her the stranger food and drink and to prepare a room where he might stay the night. The prince rested and refreshed himself and then told her of his adventure. Princess Shams al-Nahar, for that was her name, had never met anyone so brave and handsome as the prince of Persia. She put on her finest robes and adorned herself with her most precious jewels so that she might be seen in all her beauty. When the prince came to her the next morning, he was even more charmed and dazzled than before. He told her that he loved her with all his heart. But when it was time for him to take his leave and return to his father's court, the princess burst into tears. "Don't cry," he said. "I'll come back in a few days and request your hand in marriage from the king, your father." "Take me with you," implored the princess. "I cannot bear to be parted from you so soon." "Rise then and let us be off," he cried. "As soon as we arrive in Persia, we will celebrate our marriage. Then we will return in state to your father's city." He took the princess up to the palace roof, sat her on the ebony horse in front of him, placed his arm tightly around her waist, and turned the magic peg. The horse rose into the air and flew with them at great speed. Halfway through their journey, they alighted for a short rest in an orchard that was shaded with fruit trees and watered by crystal streams. After eating, they remounted the enchanted horse and flew onward to Persia. By daybreak, they came in sight of King Sabur's capital, and the happy prince brought the ebony horse to earth in the garden of his summer palace outside the city walls. He took the princess to the palace and ordered his servants to attend her. "I will leave you here and go tell my father, the king, of your arrival," he said. "Watch over my horse while I'm away. I shall send messengers to bring you in state to my father's court." Now, when the prince entered the city, he found the people dressed in black and everywhere saw signs of public mourning. Anxiously, he hurried to his father's court. Going up to one of the guards, he asked, "Why is everyone in mourning?" The prince has come back," shouted the guard. "The prince is alive!" In short while, the joyful news of the prince's return spread through the town, and the people's sorrow changed to gladness. King Sabur wept for joy on seeing him safe and sound. He embraced and kissed his son and scolded him for causing such grief and anxiety by his departure. "Guess who I brought with me?" said the prince. "Tell me, my son," the prince replied. "I have brought to our city the daughter of the king of Yemen, the most beautiful girl in all the East." And the king proceeded to tell his father of his adventure and how he had returned home with the princess. Let her be brought to our court in royal fashion, the king cried. We will receive her with the utmost honor and entertain her as our guest. Overjoyed at his son's return, King Sabur gave orders that the Persian sage should be set free and allowed to go return home. The magician, who had been expecting to suffer death at any moment, was greatly surprised at the king's pardon and was no less bewildered by the rejoicing in the streets. Upon inquiry, he was told of the return of the king's son and of the princess who was waiting outside the city gates. Without losing a moment, he rode off with all speed to the summer palace and, arriving there before the king's messengers, entered the hall where he found Shams al-Nahar lying at ease upon a couch. "Gracious princess," he said, kissing the ground before her, "the king of Persia has sent me to bring you to his court on the enchanted horse." The unsuspecting girl was very glad to hear this. She quickly got up and made ready to go with the supposed messenger. The Persian leaped onto the saddle of the ebony horse and lifted her up behind him. When he had securely fastened her to his waist, he turned the peg and the horse rose like a bird into the air. After a few moments, the princess, to her great alarm, found she was being carried far from the city and her lover. "Where are we going?" she cried. "Why do you not obey your master's orders?" "My master?" the magician echoed with an evil smile. "Who is my master?" "Why, the king," she cried. The Persian laughed. "Do you know who I am?" he asked sharply. "I know nothing of you except what you have told me," answered the princess. "Learn then," said he, "that what I told you was only a snare to trap you and the prince. That young ruffian stole my horse from me and the work of my own hands, and the loss nearly broke my heart. Now the horse is mine again, and it is the prince's turn to grieve. Come with me, gentle princess, and forget that boastful youth, for I am powerful and rich and more generous than any prince. My slaves and servants will obey you as they obey me. I will give you jewels beyond the wealth of kings and grant your every wish and fancy." The princess wept bitterly and begged the magician to take her back, but all her entreaties were of no avail. After many weary hours, they reached Turkey, where the magician brought the horse to earth in a green meadow and then went in search of food and water. Now, this meadow was near the capital. It so happened that on that day, the king of Turkey was riding nearby with his courtiers. Hearing the horses galloping past, the princess screamed and called loudly for help. The king sent his riders to her aid, and they seized the magician before he could take off on the horse. She quickly told them who she was and how she had been carried off against her will. The king was astonished at the sorcerer's ugly appearance and the girl's extraordinary beauty. He ordered his men to throw the magician into prison and took the princess and the ebony horse to his own palace. But Shams al-Nahar's troubles were by no means over, for no sooner had the king set eyes on her and listened to her story than he became infatuated with the princess and resolved to marry her himself. He turned a deaf ear to her prayers and entreaties and gave orders for the wedding preparations to begin. At last, when she saw that nothing would make him change his mind, she devised a scheme to save herself. She refused all food and drink and began to rave and scream like a woman stricken with madness. So well did she play the part that everyone believed she was really insane. The king ordered the wedding to be postponed and called his doctors to attend her. But the more they saw of her, the more they were convinced she was past all cure. Now, all this time, the prince of Persia had been wandering with a heavy heart from land to land in search of his beloved Shams al-Nahar, inquiring if anyone had seen or heard of a princess and an ebony horse. One day, at an inn in one of the great cities of Turkey, he chanced to hear the people talk about the sudden illness of a princess who had married their king. He disguised himself as a doctor, went to the royal palace, and begged an audience of the king. He introduced himself as a physician long experienced in the cure of madness and told the king he had heard of the prince's illness and had come all the way from Persia to treat her. "Honored doctor," exclaimed the joyful king, "you are most welcome." Then he told the prince the story of the girl's illness and all that had happened since the day he had found her with the old magician and the ebony horse. "I have thrown the villain into prison," he added. "As for the horse, it is being carefully guarded in the courtyard of the palace." He led the prince to the room where Shams al-Nahar was confined. They found her weeping and tearing her clothes. The disguised prince realized at once that her madness was not real, but merely a device to avoid the marriage. "Your Majesty," he said, "I must enter the room alone, or the cure will have no effect." The king left him, and the young man went up to the princess and touched her hand. "Dear princess," he said tenderly, "do you not know me?" As soon as she heard his voice, she turned to him and he great joy of recognition threw herself into his arms. "My beloved princess," he said, "be brave and patient a little longer. I have an excellent plan for our escape. But first you must make the king believe that you are improved by talking calmly to him." The prince came out of the room and said to the king, "The girl is almost cured. Enter and speak kindly to her, and all things shall go as you wish." The king marveled to see so great a change in the princess and was overjoyed when the prince told him he hoped she would be fully recovered by the next day. He ordered his women slaves to attend her and dress her in fine robes. Next morning, the prince advised the king, "Your Majesty, to complete the cure, you must go with all your courtiers to the spot where you first found the princess and take with you the girl herself and the ebony horse. For you must know that the horse is a devil whose evil power has made her mad. I will now prepare some magic incense to break the spell that binds her. Otherwise, the evil spirit will once again enter her body and our cure will work no more." "I will do as you wish," the king replied, and arranged at once to leave the city for the meadow, accompanied by the prince, the princess, and all his retinue. When they arrived, the disguised prince ordered the girl to sit upon the ebony horse and placed braziers in which sweet incense was burning all around her. Then, as swift as lightning and under the gaze of all the people, he leaped onto the saddle behind the princess and turned the peg. The horse raced straight up into the air and in a few minutes vanished from sight. The prince and princess flew under the blue sky until they arrived safely in Persia. The king and all the people were overjoyed to see them after having given up hope of their return. Celebrations were held throughout the land, and they were married amid great rejoicing. When the king died, the prince succeeded to his father's throne and lived in happiness and peace with Shams al-Nahar until the end of their days.
Wow, that was great.
Great story.
It is a great story.
Thank you so much, Mickey. Let's see, we've gone to Africa. We've gone to the Middle East. Lillian, where are you going to take us?
We are going to go to Polynesia. I'm going to be telling you the legend of the god Maui and his taming of the sun. Now, there are a number of variations of this story throughout the Polynesian islands, and I have mixed them all together and blended them. So I'm telling you a variety. It's not going to be exactly the same as told any of those particular places.
So you brought us a special blend?
A special blend.
Let me just say one thing here. I want to thank you ladies who bring us these wonderful tales. My co-producer, Kat, is over in Europe right now collecting more stories, and she was so happy when I told her that we've got these wonderful storytellers here. So I hope you will appreciate what great gifts these ladies have brought us tonight. So Lillian, with no further ado, take us to Polynesia.
Okay. Now, I can't tell you how old this legend is, but today the span from sunrise to sunset in the Hawaiian Islands varies only slightly throughout the year, by less than an hour. Now, this suggests that there's been a significant shift in the world's axis since the time the story was first told. That's how old it is, because at that time, Hawaii was located in a region with more distinctions between the summer and winter months. Once upon a time, there were four men, brothers, all having in common the name Maui. Although they were human, they were sons of supernatural beings and possessed their own supernatural powers. The youngest of the brothers was Maui of the Malo, and that is who we'll refer to as Maui today. And they say that Maui threw the heavens into their place. After fastening them so that they could not fall, he learned that he had opened a way for the sun god to come up from the lower world and rapidly run across the blue vault in the sky. This made two troubles for men. The heat of the sun was very great, and his journey was far too quickly over. Maui planned to capture the sun and punish him for thinking so little about the welfare of mankind. Maui's mother was troubled very much by the heedless taste of the sun. She had made kapa cloth, and this was the only kind of cloth known in Hawaii. It was made out of bark, except sometimes a woven mat or a long fringe strip was also worn. Now, this cloth was made from certain trees with wooden mallets until the fibers were beaten and ground into a wood pulp. Then she would pound the pulp into thin sheets. and the best looking that and clothes would be fashioned. Today, Capricorns are still made. Now, they had to be thoroughly dried, but the days were so short that by the time she had spread out the kappa, the sun had heedlessly rushed across the sky and gone into the underworld, and all the cloth had to be gathered up again and cared for until another day should come. And there were other troubles. The food could not be prepared and cooked in one day. Even an incantation to the gods could not be chanted through before one was overtaken with darkness. This was very discouraging and caused great suffering, as well as much unnecessary trouble and labor. Many complaints were made against the thoughtless son. Now he pitied his mother and determined to make the sun go slower, that the days might be long enough to satisfy the needs of men. Therefore, he went over to the northwest of the island on which he lived. This is Mount Io, which lies in one of the most beautiful and picturesque valleys. He climbed the ridges until he could see the course of the sun as it passed over the island. He saw that the sun came up on the eastern side of Mount Haleakalai. He crossed over the plain between the two mountains and climbed up to the top of the mountain, and there he watched the burning sun as it came up from Ho'olau and passed directly over the top of the mountain. Now he was taunted by a man who ridiculed the idea that he could snare the sun, saying, "You'll never catch the sun. You're only an idle nobody." Now he replied, "I will conquer my enemy, and my desire will be attained." And so, before the battle with the sun occurred, now he went down into the underworld and remained for a long time with his relatives. There he learned of an enchanted jawbone in the possession of one of his ancestors. He waited and waited, hoping that at last he might discover it. After a time, he noticed that presents of food were being sent away to some person whom he had not met. One day he asked the messengers, "Who is it you are taking that present of food to?" The people answered, "It is from Muri, your ancestress." Then he asked for the food, saying, "I will carry it to her myself." But he took the food away and hid it, and this he did for many days, and the present failed to reach the old woman. By and by she suspected mischief, for it did not seem as if her friends would neglect her for such a long time, but she thought she would catch the tricky one and eat him. She depended upon her sense of smell to detect the one who had troubled her. When Maui came along the path carrying the present of food, the old chief just sniffed and sniffed until she was sure that she smelt someone coming. She was very much exasperated, and her stomach began to distend itself that she might be ready to devour this one when he came near. Then she turned towards the south and sniffed. Not a sense of anything reached her. Then she turned toward the north and to the east, but could not detect the odor of a human being. She made one more trial and turned toward the west. Ah! Then came the sense of a man to her plainly, and she called out, "I know from the smell wafted to me by the breeze that someone is close to me." Now he made known his presence, and the old woman realized instantly that he was a descendant of hers. Her stomach began immediately to shrink and contract itself again. Then she asked, "Art thou Maui?" He answered, "Even so," and told her that he wanted the jawbone by which the great enchantments could be wrought. So Muri, the old chief, just gave him the magic stone, and Maui returned to his brothers, who were still living on the earth. After studying the path of the sun and visiting with his ancestors, Maui returned to his mother and brothers and told them that he would go out, cut off the legs of the sun so that he could not run so fast. Maui said, "Let us now catch the sun in the noose, that we may compel him to move more slowly in order that mankind may enjoy long days to get their work done and to enjoy themselves." Maui's brothers warned, "No man can approach the sun on account of the fierceness of its heat," and his mother advised him to have nothing to do with the sun, who was a divine living creature possessing a fearful energy, shaking his golden locks both morning and evening in the eyes of men. Many persons had tried to regulate the movements of the sun, but had failed completely. His mother said, "I don't think you're strong enough for this work." And he said, "Yes, I am." He encouraged his mother and his brothers by asking them to remember his power to protect himself by the use of enchantment. Then his mother gave him 15 strands of well-twisted fiber and told him to go to his grandmother, who lived in the great crater of Haleakalai, for the rest of the things in his conflict with the sun. She said, "You must climb the mountain to the place where the large woolly tree is standing. There you will find the place for the sun sets to eat cooked bananas prepared by your grandmother. Stay there until the rooster crows 3 times. Then watch your grandmother go out to make a fire and put on food. You take her bananas. She will be looking for them and find you and ask you who you are. Tell her you belong to Hana. When Hana had taught him all these things, now he went to the tip of the mountain, Kaupo, to the place Hana had directed. There was a large, really, really tree. He waited for the rooster to crow. When the rooster had crowed 3 times, the grandmother came out with a bunch of bananas to cook for the sun. She took off the upper part of the branch and laid it down. Now he immediately snatched it away. In a moment, she turned to pick it up but could not find it. She was angry and cried out, "Where are the bananas for the sun?" Then she took off another part of the bunch, and now he stole that. Thus he did until the entire bunch had been taken away. She was almost blind and could not detect him by sight, so she sniffed around until she detected the smell of a man. She asked, "Who are you? To whom do you belong?" Now he replied, "I belong to Hana. Why have you come?" Now he told her, "I've come to kill the sun. He goes so fast that he never drives the top of Hana has beaten out." Then the old woman gave Maui a magic stone for a battle axe and one more rope. She taught him how to catch the sun, saying, "Make a place to hide here by this large willy willy tree. When the first leg of the sun comes up, catch it with your first rope," and so on, until you have used all your ropes. "Fasten to the tree, then take the stone axe and strike the body of the sun." So Maui dug a hole among the roots of the tree and concealed himself. Soon the first ray of the light, the first leg of the sun, came up along the mountainside. Maui threw his rope and caught it. One by one, the legs of the sun came over the edge of the crater's rim and were caught. Only one long leg was still hanging down the side of the mountain. It was hard for the sun to move that leg. It shook and trembled and tried hard to come up. At last, it crept over the edge and was caught by Maui with the rope given by his grandmother. When the sun saw that his 16 long legs were held fast in the rope, he began to go back down the mountainside into the sea. But Maui tied the rope fast to the tree and pulled until the body of the sun came up again. Then Maui grabbed his magic battle axe and jawbone and began to strike and ruin the sun until he cried, "Give me my life!" Maui said, "If you live, you may be a traitor. Perhaps I'd better kill you." But the sun begged for his life. After they conversed a while, they reached a compromise that there should be regular motion in the journey of the sun. Half the time, he might go quickly, as in the winter time, but the other half, he must move slowly, as in the summer, so that the people dwelling on the earth should be blessed. And that's the story of how Maui tamed the sun god.
Wow, that was great.
Very clever.
Thank you so much.
Oh, really? You're quite welcome.
I think that's the first time in the Bard's Grove we've had a story from Polynesia. Thank you so much, though.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah, it's very interesting the way the ancients used to consider the heavenly bodies as gods themselves. And I think this story must relate to the eclipse, perhaps.
Sure, sure. I also thought it was interesting since they talk about the day being longer, suggesting that maybe this tale goes back before the last, pole shift.
Yeah, isn't that interesting that it would have survived that long time ago?
Maybe it's safe on the island.
Well, with the violence of the seas that I would anticipate, I don't think I want to be on an island unless there's some very high mountains there.
Well, that brings us to an ancient Egyptian story that is the legend of Re, the sun god.
Oh.
There arose from out of the darkness a great shining egg, and this was Re. In the beginning, before there was any land of Egypt, all was darkness, and there was nothing but a great waste of water called Nun. The power of Nun was such that there arose out of this darkness a great shiny egg, and this was Ray. Now Ray was all powerful, and he could take many forms. His power and the secret of it lay in his hidden name. But if he spoke other names, that which he named came into being. I am Khafra at the dawn, and Re at noon, and Atum in the evening, he said. And the sun rose and passed across the sky and set for the very first time. Then he named Shu, and the first winds blew. He named Tefnut, the spitter, and the first rain fell. Next he named Geb, and the earth came into being. He named the goddess Nut, and she was the sky arched over the earth, with her feet on one horizon and her hands on the other. He named Hapi, and the great river Nile flowed through Egypt and made it fruitful. After this, Re named all things that were upon the earth, and they grew. Last of all, he named mankind, and there were men and women in the land of Egypt. Then Re took on the shape of a man and became the first pharaoh, ruling over the whole country for thousands and thousands of years, giving such harvests that forever afterward the Egyptians spoke of the good things which happened in the time of Re. But being in the form of a man, Re grew old. In time, men no longer feared him or obeyed his laws. They laughed at him, saying, "Look at Re. His bones are like silver, his flesh like gold. His hair is the color of lapis lazuli." Re was angry when he heard this, and he was more angry still at the evil deeds which men were doing in disobedience to his laws. So he called together the gods of whom he had made, Shu and Tefnut, Geb and Nut, and he also summoned Nun. Soon the gods gathered about Re in his secret place, and the goddesses also. But mankind knew nothing of what was happening and continued to jeer at Re and to break his commandments. Then Re spoke to Nun before the assembled gods. "Eldest of the gods, you who made me, and you gods of whom I have made, look upon mankind who came into being at the glance of my eye. See how men plot against me. Hear what they say of me. Tell me what I should do, for I will not destroy mankind until I have heard what you advise." Then Nun said, "My son Re, the God greater than he who made him, mightier than those whom he has created, turn your mighty eye upon them and send destruction upon them in the form of your daughter, the goddess Sekhmet." Re answered, "Even now fear is falling upon them, and they are fleeing into the desert and hiding themselves in the mountains in terror at the sound of my voice. Send against them the glance of your eye in the form of Sekhmet," cried all the other gods and goddesses, bowing before Re until their foreheads touched the ground. And her chief delight was in slaughter, and her pleasure was in blood. So at the terrible glance of the eye of Re, his daughter came into being, the fiercest of all the goddesses. Like a lion, she rushed upon her prey, and her chief delight was in slaughter, and her pleasure was in blood. And at the bidding of Re, she came into the upper and lower Egypt to slay those who had scorned and disobeyed him. She killed them among the mountains which lie on either side of the Nile, and down beside the river, and in the burning desert, and all whom she slew, rejoicing in slaughter and the taste of blood. Presently Re looked out on the land and saw what Sekhmet had done. Then he called to her, saying, "Come, my daughter, and tell me how you have obeyed my command." Sekhmet answered with the terrible voice of a lioness as she tears her prey, by the life which you have given me, I have indeed done vengeance on mankind, and my heart rejoices. Now for many nights the Nile ran red with blood, and Sekhmet's feet were red as she went hither and thither throughout all the land of Egypt, slaying and slaying. Presently, Ray looked out over the earth once more, and now in his heart was stirred the pity for men, even though they had rebelled against him, but none could stop the cruel goddess Sekhmet, not even Ray himself. She must cease from slaying of her own accord, and Ray saw that this could only come through cunning. So he gave command, "Bring before me swift messengers who will run upon the earth as silently as shadows and with the speed of the storm winds." And when these were brought, he said to them, "Go as fast as you can up the Nile to where it flows fiercely over the rocks and among the islands of the first cataract. Go to the isle that is called Elephantine and bring from it the great store of red ochre, which is to be found there." The messengers sped their way and returned with the blood-red ochre to Heliopolis, the city where Ray shall stand with its stone obelisks with points of gold that are like fingers pointing to the sun. It was night when they came to the city, but all day the women of Heliopolis had been brewing beer as Ray had bid them. Ray came to where the beer stood waiting in 7,000 jars, and the gods came with him to see how by his wisdom he would save mankind. "Mingle the red ochre of Elephantine with the barley beer," said Ray, and it was done, so that the beer gleamed red in the moonlight like the blood of men. "Now, take it to the place where Sekhmet proposes to slay men when the sun rises," said Ray. And while it was still night, 7,000 jars of beer were taken and poured out all over the fields on the ground until it was covered to the depth of 9 inches, 3 times the measure of the palm of a man's hand, with a strong beer whose other name is Sleep Maker. When day came, Sekhmet the Terrible came also, licking her lips at the thought of the men whom she would slay. She found the place flooded and no living creature in sight, but she saw the beer which was the color of blood, and she thought it was blood indeed, the blood of those whom she had slain. And she laughed with joy, and her laughter was like the roar of a lioness hungry for the kill. Thinking that it was indeed blood, she stooped and drank. Again, and yet again she drank, laughing with delight, and the strength of the beer mounted to her brain so that she could no longer slay. At last, she came reeling back to where Ray was waiting. That day she had not killed. Then Ray said, "You come in peace, sweet one." And her name was changed to Hathor. And her nature was changed also to the sweetness of love and the strength of desire. And henceforth Hathor laid low men and women only with the great power of love. But forever after, her priestesses drank in her honor of the beer of Heliopolis, colored with the red ochre of Elephantine when they celebrated her festival each new year. So mankind was saved, and Ray continued to rule, old though he was. But the time was drawing near when he must leave the earth to reign forever in the heavens, letting the younger gods rule in his place. For dwelling in the form of man of a pharaoh of Egypt, Ray was losing his wisdom. Yet he continued to reign, and no one could take his power from him, since that power dwelt in the secret name, which none knew but himself. If only anyone could discover his name of power, Ray would no longer reign on earth. But only by magic arts was this possible. Geb and Nut had children. These were the younger gods whom Day had come to rule, and their names were Osiris and Isis, Nephthys and Seth. Of these, Isis was the wisest. She was cleverer than a million men. Her knowledge was greater than that of a million of the noble dead. She knew all things in heaven and earth, except only for the secret name of Ray. And now that she set upon herself to learn by guile. And I'll stop the story there. Ladies.
That to be continued?
To be continued, indeed, indeed.
Oh, darn.
A cliffhanger.
Such intrigue.
Now, what was the other name for the beer? Sweet Maker or Sleep Maker?
Sleep.
Sleep Maker.
Yes, okay. You drink too much beer, you fall asleep.
Yeah, no, that's what I thought. But she turned sweet. She turned nice.
Yes, yes,
right?
She went from the cat-headed or lion-headed goddess to the goddess with the cow head, Hathor, the nurturer.
Maybe we need to create a new holiday where we drink red beer.
Well, I thought it was
interesting. In honor of a woman going from evil to sweet and kind.
Sure. I thought it was interesting because most people have heard something of Osiris and maybe Set, and certainly
Osiris comes from the three sisters, the star formation that the pyramids were lined up with. Osiris is the name of one of those stars.
Uh-huh.
And the theory was that was the name of the Egyptian ruler was behind the design of the three pyramids in Egypt.
Well, this was the only time I've ever seen the story of Sekhmet and Hathor told. So I thought that transitioned from what we might call a bloody epoch to an epoch of love. I thought that was interesting and maybe useful in our time.
It almost sounds like...
Yeah, we got to get everybody drunk.
Yes. I love it. Well, it sounds like it was in the shift period, another ending the age of Pisces and going into the age of Aquarius. There sounds like it could have been something like that.
Uh-huh.
Of course, it's a cliffhanger, so we don't know yet.
Well, I hope that you ladies will come up with another story for next week.
Oh, yeah, and CJ will be with us next week, too, with another African tale.
That's fantastic. So I want to thank each of you, Margaret, Mickey, Lillian. Thank you so very much for sharing a tale with us tonight.
It was delightful.
You're welcome.
And go ahead.
It was fun.
Well, I'm glad you joined us here in the Bard's Grove. These stories are brought to you through the good efforts of Kathy Pagano, therapist, dream researcher, and also the work of Imagineering Productions. I hope you'll give us a call or drop us a note. And I want you to join me thanking these wonderful ladies who joined us tonight, Margaret, Mickey, and Lillian. It has been truly a great gift you've brought us. And I thank you.
Thank you.
It's a privilege to be here.
You're welcome.
And ladies and gentlemen, remember, if you don't catch our shows live, you can always tune in anytime. The shows are all recorded. And it has been our pleasure sharing from the depths of the Bard Grove these wonderful tales that exist beyond time, that speak
to
us.
To be continued.
Tune in next week for the next chapter.
Do any of you ladies know what you'll be bringing us next week?
I've got a lot to do.
Go ahead, Margaret.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you all, and we'll see you again next week when the Bard's Grove brings you new tales from the depths of the Bard Grove. Thank you again.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Good night.
We'll see you next week. Night from the Bard's Grove.